Senate Judiciary Committee meeting to order. We are joined by phone by the committee chair, who not well enough to be with us in person, but listening in and joining us. So we're thankful that she can do that. We're going to reverse the order from the published order, and we're going to start with Senate Bill 287 and 288, and we'll be opening, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 287 and 288. We'll be looking at those together, and we'll invite Tom Leniger to come up and explain the two measures to us, and then we'll have that other testimony that you get here.
Thank you, Senator Starr and members of the committee. It's a privilege to come today, and with the time allotted to me, I'd like to make just three brief points. The first is I wanted to explain this Supreme Court ruling last year in Crawford v. Washington. Second, I wanted to address its impact in certain categories of crime and the prosecutions of those categories of crime here in Oregon in particular. And third, I wanted to explain the particular proposal before you today, and incidentally, the one that I was involved in creating is Senate Bill 287. I understand that Tim Sylvester from the State Department of Justice may be able to add some insight into the reasons why the Department of Justice offered a slightly different version, Senate Bill 288, I believe is the number, but it's a very similar concept. And then I wanted, in connection with the third point, to sort of place this proposal in an overall context of reforms that may help to ameliorate the impact of Crawford. First, if I can introduce myself, I'm a law professor at the University of Oregon. I'm not here today on behalf of the University of Oregon, but that's the reason why I've spent so much time focusing on Crawford and its impact in evidence law. I've also been appointed as chair of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission, and I've worked as a prosecutor for 7 years, so I come from that background. The Crawford decision was a decision in March of 2004. And to summarize that case in a way that risks oversimplification, I think it's possible to boil it down to one proposition. And that is the notion that when the government offers hearsay, an out-of-court statement for its truth, when the government offers hearsay and doesn't actually put the speaker, the declarant, in the witness chair, the government has to do one of two things now in a criminal trial. The government either must somehow make that out-of-court declarant, that speaker, available for cross-examination in the present criminal trial. That's choice number one. Or the government must show that today's defendant, today's accused, once had a chance to cross-examine the speaker of that out-of-court statement. And so basically, it's an insistence on cross-examination as a condition for the admission of hearsay. It changes many states' laws quite a lot, and Oregon is one of those states. While Oregon, in State v. Moore, in 2002, had a fairly demanding confrontation requirement, it was not as high a bar as the U.S. Supreme Court set in the year 2004. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court included one additional facet to this very important decision. That additional facet was that the Supreme Court mentioned it continued to observe this old doctrine whereby a defendant whose wrongful conduct is the reason why the speaker wouldn't come to court can't exclude that speaker's hearsay. It's an equitable notion. If your hands are unclean, if you're the reason why this victim of crime, perhaps, is too afraid to come to court because of your conduct that intended that result, then the Supreme Court blessed this longstanding doctrine that it's okay to admit hearsay statements because this defendant's wrongdoing is the reason for that witness's absence. And many of us who study evidence law were very interested in the fact that the Supreme Court, although in dicta, upheld or mentioned the continuing vitality of that doctrine. So, Senator Ringo, I just was mentioning a bit about the Crawford decision, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions at this stage about what Crawford meant before I proceed to the next stage, which is to discuss Crawford's impact on domestic violence and other prosecutions in Oregon. Are there any questions at this stage?
Any questions from the committee members? I think you've been quite clear.
Thank you. If you don't mind, Senator Starr, I was then going to proceed to the second stage about how the Crawford case affects our prosecutions in Oregon of certain crimes involving vulnerable victims. The useful background here would just be the understanding that I know many of the legislators in this room have, which is that in certain categories of crime, victims are reluctant to come forward, domestic violence victims in particular, elder abuse victims, victims of child abuse, for a wide range of reasons, including economic dependence on the abuser, maybe fear of reprisals by the abuser, a continued attachment to the abuser, and for many other reasons. These are potential trial witnesses who may give a candid statement to police on the first day the police come to take the statement, but 70 days later or 6 months later, when the case proceeds to trial, for the reasons I've discussed or other reasons, these victims may choose to absent themselves, they may prefer not to testify at all, or they may recant, which means change their story. And there's some evidence that 80 to 85% of all victims of domestic violence will either refuse to cooperate or will recant. And what Oregon has done up until 2004 is rely on largely on the statements these victims made within 24 hours of the abuse to law enforcement officers. We had an exception here in Oregon that was used quite a lot to solve that problem. Well, that exception has been called into question and will certainly be limited somewhat since the Crawford decision. And one thing that I did in connection with my research for an article in the Virginia Law Review is conduct a survey of every prosecutor's office, if I could, in California, Oregon, and Washington, and I asked a series of questions about how the Crawford case has affected the handling of domestic violence cases. I was able to speak with domestic violence prosecutors in counties in those three states that collectively take in 90% of the population of those three states. And here in Oregon, I was able to survey prosecutors' offices in jurisdictions that collectively take in 94% of Oregon's population. And what I found was pretty alarming. I found that 89% of the respondents in Oregon considered the Crawford decision to be a significant impediment on their prosecutions of domestic violence. And that figure contrasted with 51% of respondents in Washington and California. Still a high number, but nowhere near as high as Oregon. I think there are a number of reasons why Oregon was especially burdened by Crawford. One is that our state had relied heavily on the special domestic violence hearsay exception and child abuse exception that will be harder to use now in the wake of the Crawford decision. Also, prosecutors in Washington and California have some different tools from what we use in Oregon. And the short story is their tools are more durable after Crawford than our tools are. And so I'm one of the people you'll be hearing from in the next several months who may suggest that we begin to avail ourselves in Oregon of statutory means of enabling prosecutors to bring effective hearsay or domestic violence prosecutions after the Crawford decision. And what I wanted to, if I could just segue now into the third part of my presentation, unless there are any questions.
Any questions?
Thank you. I just wanted to speak in favor of the one proposal I presented. There are two proposals before you. One is a slightly revised version of what I proposed that has been revised by the State Department of Justice, and one is the version I proposed, which I believe has the lower number. All that I proposed was a single sentence of language that already appears in the Federal Rules of Evidence. It's Federal Rule of Evidence 804B6. You may be aware that Oregon's evidence code comes almost entirely from the Federal Rules of Evidence. We imported the Federal Rules wholesale to Oregon in 1975, or after 1975 when the Federal Rules were adopted. However, this particular sentence was included in the Federal Rules in 1997. I don't believe that we've ever rejected it in Oregon. It's just that we don't systematically update our rules in Oregon to incorporate federal changes. So I wanted to mention that background so that this rule doesn't seem radical. It derives from the same set of rules where we got most of our evidentiary rules. The rule says, in a nutshell, that a person who has caused, through wrongful conduct, the absence of a witness cannot be heard to protest that witness's absence as an objection to the admission of hearsay. In other words, if it's your fault why this witness didn't come to court, we're not going to allow you to raise the constitutional argument, I should be able to confront my accuser. We're not going to allow you to raise the statutory hearsay argument But out-of-court statements are generally admissible. They're not here because of your wrongful conduct. That's the rule in a nutshell. And I think this could be a very important development in our evidence code for a number of reasons. First of all, the Crawford decision has really heightened the importance of the victim's testimony. And this is why a number of states, Washington, Maryland, are right now holding hearings. In fact, I attended one in Washington, and a friend of mine is doing one in Maryland, to consider adopting this very provision, because after Crawford, the victim is so important, much more so than before, for the government to make its case for domestic violence or elder abuse. And that defendant knows if the victim could become unavailable, then the charges might go away. So the temptation is much stronger now after Crawford than ever before for the defendant to threaten or entice or use wrongful means to keep that accuser out of court. So now that the stakes are higher than ever, and it seems to be an opportune time to adopt a rule that many states have already adopted in the course of adopting the federal rules. I'd be happy to answer questions about that. I wanted to maybe offer a preview of what I've heard maybe coming before this committee. This proposal here is not a fix in itself of the problems created by Crawford. It would be an important step, I believe, and it would modernize our evidence code as many other states and the federal government have modernized their codes. But there are some other proposals that will be coming that will be complementary with this proposal. I understand that the district attorneys have worked with legislative counsel on a proposal to widen the permissible means of impeaching a witness. For example, in these cases where a witness recants, a victim of domestic violence, say, comes to court but says, no, unlike what I told the officers the day my boyfriend was arrested, he didn't actually hit me in the cheek. I fell down the stairs, and that's why my cheek was swollen. And this story is contradicted by the witness's prior story to police. Well, other jurisdictions, including our neighbors to the north and south, allow wider use of that prior statement where the witness testifies. It's a broader version of 801D1 is what those other jurisdictions have than we have. And I believe that their wider impeachment rules, more permissive impeachment rules, are a good part of the reason why they showed less impediment after Crawford, why their prosecutions involving vulnerable victims weren't impacted so much by Crawford. So I think Bradbury and the DAs will bring that proposal before you. And I understand that out of the Multnomah County DA's office, there may be a proposal to establish new pretrial junctures for cross-examination, recognizing that many of these victims may be candid shortly after the offense, but less so before the time of trial, or may be vulnerable to coercion by the time of trial. So the idea is to subject them to the cross-examination the Constitution requires before trial. So another bill you'll likely see would create a new means of subjecting a witness to pretrial cross-examination in a pretrial hearing just for that purpose. And then I guess I'll just highlight those two provisions, but I hope you'll give this bill serious consideration, as other states have. And I know that Sybil Hebb, who is an important domestic violence advocate, is here from Portland, and we had asked Mr. Taylor if we could split our time so that she could help to illustrate why a bill like this is important to victims of domestic violence.
Senator Ringo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for coming to testify today. Is there any data on the reliability of the reports of domestic violence when those reports were made shortly after the event?
Yes, I've read studies, and the studies indicate empirically that those reports made closest in time to the event, in particular reference to domestic violence, are more likely to be accurate than those reports or testimony given in closer proximity to trial. Now, I can't tell you exactly what the methodology for those studies was, and the problem is no one saw what happened, but that's a sensible concern. Our version of the domestic violence hearsay exception recognizes the possibility those statements need to be screened further, and so 803.26 in Oregon includes a number of factors that must be assessed to determine whether the statement given to the officers was reliable. But I think in terms of the candor of the declarant, it seems to be greatest shortly after the incident, as opposed to 70 days later on the eve of trial.
Follow-up, Mr.
Thank you. Is there, obviously the goal is to ensure the reliability of the statement, and I'm wondering if, particularly in the context of domestic violence, whether the statements of the victim can be audiotaped or videotaped or recording in a way rather than just the officer's scribbled notes, so that then it's that much harder for the person to say, well, I really didn't mean that when I said it. Is there thought given to that?
I think that's an excellent concern, and maybe Senator Pruszynski and Senator Walker can correct me, but I know that some police departments, apparently including the Eugene Police Department, are now considering measures to voluntarily tape more statements for precisely that reason. It enhances the reliability of the evidence. It makes jurors more likely to rely on those statements. And I think now when it's clear that if the defendant, through wrongful conduct, procures the absence of a witness, then the best way of communicating to the jury what that witness would have said is a tape-recorded statement. This bill, just to be clear, would not require tape recording, but I understand that there's been a movement in many areas, and I believe including Eugene, to increase the recording of statements just for that reason. I think what Crawford told us is not to be cavalier in assuming that all out-of-court statements are reliable, and so I think officers and prosecutors who want to make a good presentation are bringing as much detail as they can.
Thank you. Just one more, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
The type of statements we're talking about are, for domestic violence, are these statements usually made to the police officers at the scene so that the statements are just hand recorded in his notebook, or are they taken down at a station where there, I guess, is a little more structure to how the statement is given?
Well, I understand there are many different protocols in different jurisdictions, and one protocol that I understand has been particularly effective is to conduct an interview not solely involving the officer who led the assailant away in handcuffs, but also involving someone who's maybe a little more savvy in counseling and in understanding the difficult psychological circumstances. So I think the literature says that the best of these interviews involve perhaps two interviewers, one the police officer, one a person more sensitive.
But in terms of how they're usually done.
Yeah, I think usually a police officer.
Usually, is what we're talking about mostly is a statement at the scene and handwritten notes by a police officer.
Right. And I think those statements, while generally reliable, are disfavored by comparison to live trial testimony. And this bill does not change that hierarchy of preference. It'd be much better to bring the witness to court. This bill would only provide that when a defendant can be shown by a preponderance of evidence to have willfully procured the absence of that witness, then we'll go to the second string because of the wrongful conduct of that defendant. So I don't want to misrepresent that these are infallible statements or that they're somehow as good as trial testimony, but I think on the spectrum of hearsay, they're kind of toward the more reliable pole.
That's fine. I just want to be sure that so I understand what you're talking about, that in practice, the statements that we're talking about usually are ones that were taken at the scene and are recorded in handwriting by the officer. That more of the statements fall on that side of it than being recorded at the station.
I believe so. I don't know for a fact, but that seems more typical.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Professor Reining, could you tell me, I know the answer, but I'm just going to ask you this anyway. Could you tell me, this is a problem all across the country because it was the U.S. Supreme Court who made this ruling. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And this was not something that was foreseen when we drafted our unique hearsay exceptions here in Oregon. We had a counterbalance between our Oregon Constitution, enforced a certain way in State v. Moore, and our local hearsay exceptions. And what really upset the apple cart is that the higher authority came in and said, now all confrontation needs at least this floor, and so we need to re-examine our hearsay law after that.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the second question to that is, we're not the only state looking at dealing with the Crawford decision. Would that be true?
Absolutely. I think that one reason why many states are revisiting their evidence code right now is the very Crawford decision. I don't think that there has been a similar time in recent history where all states are focusing on criminal evidence as they are now, and it's because of the Crawford decision.
And a final? Thank you. And then finally, Professor, would you say that other states are very much interested in what Oregon has put forward and are actually looking at that as model legislation?
I do believe that's true. Oregon's always been at the cutting edge with domestic violence, hearsay exceptions in particular. Just as an example, 803.26, the particular hearsay exception for cases involving domestic violence, which was passed, I believe, in 1999, was written up in the Columbia Law Review as a model for the country, is one of the most significant pieces of domestic violence legislation in recent history. And I think the nation looks to Oregon and has always been particularly interested in how Oregon pioneers strategies for helping vulnerable victims.
Thank you, Professor. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want the committee to know how much Professor Leininger has put into this bill. He contacted me this summer and asked if I'd work on it with him, and I think he's done the lion's share of the work, I just want people to know that he's really done a great job with this.
Thank you very much for your involvement in the bill.
Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Mr. Chair. Professor Leininger, when you talk about the wrongful conduct of the defendant in the context of the domestic violence, allowing the statement in, do you mean, for example, on the assault, the fact that the person has committed the assault, the defendant has allegedly committed the assault, or do you mean something more than that, that they have also threatened the witness?
Very important question, and I think this is a distinction between the version of the bill I originally drafted and the version the State Department of Justice has drafted, which is slightly different. The version I've suggested is just the exact language of the federal rules, and it's the language that most states that have such a rule follow. It requires that the conduct at issue include the subjective intent to silence the witness. So the mere fact that you hit the witness, and he or she, the victim, is thereafter scared of you, is not in itself sufficient under the language I propose. What is generally required under 804b6, which would be copied here, is that the victim undertake some act with the actual subjective intent thereby of silencing the witness. Now, the only situation in which it's not necessary under the case law interpreting 804b6 to have that specific intent to procure the unavailability of the witness is murder. And I think the theory there is that no one should profit from killing a prospective declarant. And so there, most of the cases in 2004 have found that a provision like 804b6 doesn't require specific subjective intent to make the witness unavailable, because we all know that's the result when you murder somebody. Other than that particular example of murder, any act to qualify under the version I've written must have been committed not only with the intent to commit that crime, but with the intent thereby to cause the witness to be unavailable. So if I could just offer a few examples, I think what would count would be an assailant looks right at the victim and says, if you tell anyone, I'll come after you and hit you again. What wouldn't count is if repeated
violence
just left a general feeling of fear. That wouldn't count under the language I've offered. It may possibly count under the language offered by the State Department of Justice. I was just a little more cautious knowing that our state has typically followed, for the most part, the language of the federal rules, and knowing that if the state were to follow this language, you have 10 years of case law to make clear that this is constitutionally permissible, it will stand up in court, and it will be used effectively, because other states have already, in the federal government, have already figured out how this language operates in court.
Yes, Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, thank you for being here. I want to get your input on the two bills. I've looked at them, and I'm assuming the one that you're referring to that you drafted was the 287. And then in comparison to 288, it does have that extra clause that's on the bottom of page 2, starting on line 28, where it says a statement is not admissible under the provisions of this section if the declarant is unavailable as a witness because the proponent of the statement engaged or acquiesced in the wrongdoing that caused the declarant from being unavailable. It seems to me that that's really a balancing, that actually maybe there should be a blending of these two bills so that the statement can be used against the individual who caused the declarant not to be available, and at the same time we shouldn't allow the proponent of that statement to benefit by somehow keeping that person out because they're afraid that it may change. I mean, we got impeachment. We have ways of dealing with that. and I'm wondering if you can give us your opinion as to whether or not that there should be a blending, and basically taking 287 and just including that extra provision that's in the end of 288.
I very much agree with the need for that symmetry. I very much agree with Senator Przanski. My understanding from reading Oregon's version of Rule 804 is that language regarding the proponent's wrongdoing already appears at the end of subpoint A of Rule 804. And so that's why I didn't incorporate that language in the bill that I drafted, but I would be, however the committee in its wisdom wants to incorporate both those comments or those notions, I think it's very important, and I'm not here to tell you that my version is the only possible version. I definitely agree there needs to be language that says the proponent can't, you know, the person offering the hearsay can't benefit from wrongdoing, just as the proposal I've made stops the opponent from benefiting from wrongdoing. No one should benefit from wrongdoing. So I agree with Senator Przanski. When I drafted this rule, I had a look at the Oregon evidence rule, and I believe that the requirement that the proponent not engage in wrongdoing was already in there under Rule 804, as it is in the federal system, and I defer to your greater wisdom on Oregon law, and just hope that both those comments or those concepts end up in the final version of the bill.
Further questions? Senator Burdick, you. You bet. With that, we thank you for your testimony, and we're going to move on. We have several others. Looks like perhaps they signed up.
Sybil,
yep. You were sharing time with Mr. Lediger. Could you come and share with us, please?
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and Chair Starr, members of the committee. My name is Sybil Hebb. I'm an attorney with the Oregon Law Center and newly their legislative advocate. I'm here today because although our clients are, we represent clients only in civil cases, a number of our clients are domestic violence and sexual assault victims and elder abuse victims, and so we have a public policy interest in this issue and this bill. And I wanted to present to you a few comments about the impact this bill will have on survivors and victims in the state of Oregon. I'm passing around my testimony and then also a chart that sort of summarizes the impact of the Crawford decision that I have found useful and thought it might be to the committee as well. I wanted to make just three simple points, and one is that I agree with Professor Leininger's great testimony that as a result of this Crawford decision, there is a greater emphasis than ever before on the participation of the victim in prosecution cases, and that for many reasons puts victims in a very awkward and potentially dangerous circumstance. This bill will not be able to solve all of those problems, but it is an important step in addressing that dilemma. I wanted to take a minute just to talk about the various problems that victims face in deciding whether or how to participate in a criminal prosecution. There may be circumstances in which there has been there have been threats of retaliation and there have been actual threats. There are also many other circumstances in which, because of past behavior and because of fears of retaliation, even if they weren't particularly threatened, when a victim feels unsafe in going through the process. And we have, as a result of Crawford, been hearing through listservs and the like examples of circumstances in which victims who have been reluctant to testify because of fear have been brought into jail and incarcerated and held pending trial in order to have their participation in the prosecution. And of course that gives great concern to the victim advocacy community, because such procedures have such an incredible impact on the victim, but also on the family members, children who may be involved, on employment, housing, and the list goes on. So I wanted to really applaud this step as a really creative way of helping prosecutors have tools by which they can move forward with their cases when the victim is unable because of fear to participate in the trial. I also wanted to stress that the bill is based on a basic concept of fairness and justice, and that the concept that a person should not benefit by wrongdoing, and so we're supportive of that because of the fairness and justice, but also because of the impact that it will have on survivors. I wanted to also just take this opportunity to stress that this is, again, one of many ways in which we can deal with the impact of Crawford and the impact that it has had, or the gaping holes that it has left in Oregon's current evidence code, and make you aware of a program called the Family Justice Center, which is in San Diego and run by a prosecutor named Casey Gwynn. And he has written extensively about the impact of the Family Justice Center on victims' abilities to participate in prosecutions. By providing advocacy to the victim and any children involved at every stage of the prosecution, providing support, either counseling, legal assistance, assistance with housing and public benefits, that sort of support provided to a victim going through this process has really increased their participation rate in San Diego. And Casey Green offers that model as yet another creative way to reduce the impact of Crawford by focusing on victim advocacy to better enable participation rather than on forcing victims to participate against their will or in circumstances when they would be in danger. So I'd be happy to offer any questions, but that's the support I wanted to offer for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? No questions. Thank you very much.
Good job, sir.
We will go forward. Tim Sylvester. Cheryl O'Neill, could you
Chair Burdick, Chair Starr, members of the committee. I'm Tim Sylvester from the Oregon Department of Justice. I would concur in everything Professor Reininger just said. We support both of the bills. The one comment I wanted to make was to illustrate the distinction between Senate Bill 287 and 288. If you'll note, in Senate Bill 287, there is a requirement in order for the forfeiture by wrongdoing rule to apply and the evidence to become available against a defendant, the state would be obliged to prove that the defendant's conduct was intended to cause the declarant to be unavailable, whereas in Senate Bill 288, there is no requirement that the state, in order to use the exemption, would have to show that the intent was to make the declarant unavailable. And I will give you several real-world examples on why I think it's important. We think it's important not to require a showing of specific intent. There was a rather notorious case that was recently affirmed in the Oregon Court of Appeals the other day involving Bradley Cunningham, who was a man who murdered his wife up in Washington County. And one of the issues that went all the way to the Oregon Supreme Court and then back down to the Court of Appeals was whether certain statements the wife had made, the victim had made shortly before the murder, would be admissible over a hearsay objection. The Oregon Supreme Court eventually upheld the admissibility of those statements, but under other hearsay exceptions, if 288 became law, the victim statements would have been admissible without any further showing, simply a showing that Mr. Cunningham had caused her to be unavailable by killing her. And there wouldn't have to be a showing that he killed her specifically with the intent to silence her. In the case of a murder, and I think Professor Reininger pointed out, is that under the federal rule of evidence, I think the case law is the courts are not requiring a specific intent to silence the victim. But the way that Senate Bill 287 is worded, the rule itself would require that, or could be construed to require a showing of specific intent to silence the witness and prevent her from being a witness, in addition to merely wanting to cause her death. Another good example I have is one that we had in our office recently that involved elder abuse. This situation arises not only in the case of physical domestic violence, but in other circumstances too. And we had a case that came into our office in which somebody who had taken on the care of an elderly person was mistreating that person, not taking care of them, and mixing up the prescription medicines. And as a result, the person became increasingly incompetent to the point where the person no longer would be competent as a witness. Now, we wouldn't be able probably to show that the person was mistreating the elderly person for the purpose of rendering him incompetent to be a witness, but the fact is that what the person did had that result. And in that situation, it's our belief that the defendant who was then charged with criminal mistreatment should not be able to rely on the fact that the person is now incompetent in order to exclude that person's otherwise relevant hearsay evidence. And another case that recently that reviewed was one in which someone called and said that they had a victim of domestic violence who, as a result of years and years of physical and emotional abuse, was simply incompetent at this point in being a witness against her abuser. And there was no specific evidence that in that recent past the abuser had made specific threats to the victim in order to preclude her from being a witness, but the sum effect of the years of abuse and the way that this was handled by him was that she was no longer psychologically able to be a witness in the case. And from our standpoint, it doesn't make any sense to require a specific showing that the defendant had engaged in the conduct, had committed the abuse, had committed the murder for the specific intent of silencing the witness, if we could show that that was the necessary or the direct result of what his conduct was, is that the victim became unavailable as a witness. That's all I have, unless members of the committee have questions.
Senator Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair. Tim, I follow that. I appreciate that. I guess the one thing I heard Ms. Langler say was that the model or the what he has drafted in 287 is actually what's in federal code now and has been on the books for 10 years.
Yes.
So I'm wondering, based on what DOJ has put forward, do we have any history or authority as to making certain that we're not going to find ourselves in a situation that it may be held, I'm going to say unconstitutional, are challenged in court and where we may end up?
Chair Starr, Senator Brzezinski, the answer to that is I don't think we have any history on that. The United States Supreme Court in Crawford, in dicta, as Professor Langer pointed out, left open the possibility that the long history of the common law exception for forfeiture by wrongdoing would allow for certain types of evidence to be admitted over a Crawford sort of objection. And my understanding of the common law forfeiture by wrongdoing exception is that it does not necessarily require a showing of specific intent to silence the witness so long as there is a direct causation link. That is an area that I think is currently in flux, and the law is developing in that area. One of the concerns that I would have in this is that if we follow the federal rule and we draw the exception narrowly, and the case law later on develops under the Crawford that the exception for purposes of the Sixth Amendment is actually broader, what we've done is we've adopted a narrow rule that isn't as broad as the Sixth Amendment would allow. And so if we adopt at this point a broader rule that would allow the exception to apply even without specific intent, and that is where the Sixth Amendment law eventually leads, then we have a broad enough rule to cover that situation. But to answer your question, Senator Brzezinski, that there is not specific at this point precedent one way or the other on that point, and the law is continuing to develop. And I don't know if you have any specific.
May I also respond to Senator Pozanski? I definitely agree with everything that Mr. Sylvester said, and I think he's accurately distinguished. I apologize, Tom Leininger and Senator Starr and members of the committee. I just was hoping to add on to what Mr. Sylvester had stated. I think he's accurately described the differences between the bill, and as I told Mr. Taylor, I don't oppose this formulation. I think it's accurate to say that the version I proposed is just derived verbatim from the federal rules, so it's been tested by time, but I hope that my comments won't be construed as doubt that this version would stand up in court. And one reason why I feel comfortable proposing a narrow exception is prosecutors have to surmount two hurdles in a criminal prosecution. One, they have to find a statute that their hearsay will fit into, and then second, they have to beat the constitutional hurdle. Now, in Oregon, unless we throw out 803.26 and 803.18a, the statute is unlikely to be the problem for many domestic violence or child abuse cases. We have a lot of opportunities in the statute as long as we can get around the constitutional problem. So Oregon's statutory hearsay law is actually more expansive than most states. And so I think that to add this language, which addresses both stages, both the statutory stage and I think also memorializes this constitutional doctrine deriving from the Supreme Court case Reynolds from 100 years ago, I don't think this would constrain Oregon prosecutors, because if their proposed hearsay doesn't fit easily in this statute, we have many other statutes, and then you could bring in the constitutional theory at the constitutional stage of the review to explain why there's been equitable forfeiture. So it's a long way of saying I don't feel as fearful that this restrictive, comparatively restrictive federal language would really hamstring Oregon prosecutors, because we still have 803.18, we still have 803.26, which are broader than the tools available to most prosecutors. So I think the two complement each other, but I don't oppose this proposal.
Yes,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mr. Sylvester, the question I posed earlier to Professor Leininger, in the situation where you have a person who's in a domestic violence situation has assaulted their spouse under Sinnefield, and that's all they've done, there's no statement that has been made, and the wife decides not to testify, under 288, would that be considered the witness is unavailable, or would it require more than that?
Chair Starr, Mr. Taylor, it would require something more than that in this sense. There has to be a showing under 288 that the witness, in fact, is unavailable. It says a statement offered against a party that has engaged in or acquiesced in wrongdoing that caused the victim to be, the declarant to be unavailable. And so there has to be a showing that the person is, in fact, unavailable, that is, either physically, mentally, psychologically, or otherwise incompetent or incapable of testifying. And if you have a victim, a declarant who is simply scared, that person may not be necessarily unavailable. But the example that I gave you was one who, in which the victim, through years of abuse and intimidation and that sort of thing, had come to the point where she simply was incompetent, incapable, psychologically unavailable to testify. Now, in that situation, there wouldn't have to be an additional showing that there was a specific threat from the defendant to the victim that precipitated the unavailability, simply that the victim, the declarant, is unavailable as a result of conduct, wrongdoing done by the defendant. Does that answer your question, Mr. Taylor?
I think so. Mr. Chairman, as a committee, I have just a couple more questions.
Please
bear with me. When I looked at the notes under the federal law, I noticed unavailability also includes the exercise of the husband-wife privilege. And when I read Oregon law, either the husband or wife can exercise the privilege. Now, my assumption would be is that if the husband were to exercise the privilege, would that make the witness unavailable?
Senator Starr, Mr. Taylor, I think the way that the current rule is written, or the draft is written, is it requires
that the party against whom the statement is being offered engaged in wrongdoing.
Okay.
And maybe Professor Leininger has a different understanding of that, but I think that the exercise of a privilege would not be wrongdoing within the meaning of that rule.
I agree, and the Crawford case itself arose because the husband and wife had invoked privileges, and you might argue that the husband had sort of gamed the process, but were the doctrine of forfeiture by wrongdoing applicable in that case, the Crawford decision wouldn't have gotten that far because it would have been shut down by the wrongdoing of the defendant. So I think the answer is invoking a valid privilege is not wrongdoing.
Thank you, Mr. Chief. Thank you.
Further questions from the committee?
Just one. Mr. Chair, actually for either one of you, I was just sitting there thinking about this. If a gentleman were accused of killing his wife, then she would be unavailable for testimony because she allegedly was dead by his hand. But how could you admit her evidence without assuming he was guilty?
That's an excellent question, and I haven't done a good job of explaining the mechanics of how this bill works. When courts determine the admissibility of evidence, a judge will first find whether there exists a preponderance of evidence. It's a much more lenient standard, more favorable to the proponent than proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So the court has to decide, have all the threshold requirements to admit a piece of evidence been met. And in this case, the court would just have to find basically 51% proof that it's more... There's more proof favoring the fact that he killed his wife than disfavoring the fact that he killed his wife. In order for the jury then to be able to hear the hearsay statements from the wife to a police officer, perhaps she spoke to an officer a week before the murder and said, you know, my husband has threatened to kill me. My husband just bought a gun and said he's going to put it to my head. So those statements, the admissibility would be judged by a much different standard from the standard by which the guilt or innocence of the defendant is judged by the jury. And it's one is 51% proof, and one is whatever the proof beyond a reasonable doubt is. You know, some people describe that as 90% proof. And so in that case, most courts do find that killing the declarant, even without the intent to make her unavailable at trial, just killing her for the sake of killing someone or a man or a woman, would be sufficient wrongdoing to invoke this doctrine. And then the next step is to say, all right, prosecutor, how much proof do you have that this defendant killed that witness? Now, this is all done outside the presence of the jury, probably pretrial. And so in this pretrial hearing, then the government would say, well, you know, here's the evidence we have. A hearsay could be introduced at that point, proving that by a preponderance of the evidence, there's sufficient proof to show this defendant killed this witness. Then the judge might say, okay, so when it comes time for trial, I don't want to hear any talk about this hearing, except that you may then offer the hearsay evidence without an objection. In other words, you may then have your officer testify, then I spoke with the woman and she said, my husband's bought a gun. She said, my husband has once pointed the gun at me. But there won't be a replay of that pretrial hearing where there was a discussion of how much we can adduce, how much proof we can adduce that the defendant killed his wife. And I think that that's a valid concern. If it were possible to bootstrap a conviction just by making that predicate showing to get the evidence in, well, then the jury hears, well, the judges just said he did it by 51%, now we should convict the guy. And what makes me comfortable is that discussion happens before trial, outside the presence of the jury. And then all the jury hears is that hearsay evidence with no judgment about whether or not the man killed his wife.
Yes. Then, essentially, from your explanations, I understand it, by 51% of the preponderance of evidence, and prejudicial evidence would be administered to the, applied to the jury.
That's an excellent question, and there will be a separate inquiry at the end of that determination. There's a separate inquiry as to whether the prejudicial effect substantially outweighs the probative value. In fact, at the end of every evidentiary determination, a trial judge would need to decide, you know, now I've seen that this evidence fits in all the statutory holes, but at the end of every evidentiary question, the judge has to ask, would admitting this evidence cause so much prejudice that the prejudice would outweigh the useful part of the evidence? And so this inquiry doesn't change that rule. That rule is always out there. And if it turns out that by admitting hearsay under this statute, There is such great prejudice that it makes it impossible for the defendant to get a fair trial. The judge won't admit it. That's how our system is set up. It's Rule 403, where a judge should never admit evidence of any sort, where admission of that evidence would cause such great prejudice. But were the committee to adopt this language that's been in federal court for 10 years, I'd feel pretty comfortable that we wouldn't have that problem because it hasn't arisen in federal court in 10 years. I think that's one of the reasons I felt more comfortable sticking by the time-tested language. But those are very valid concerns.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Thanks. Just one follow-up. Mr. Sylvester, if the committee chose to go with 287 as the language it wanted, would you request or would you think it would be appropriate to have, quote-unquote, a murder exception into that language so it would, in fact, make certain that if a person was being tried for the murder of the person who would be the declarant, that those testimony or those statements would come in?
Chair Starr, Senator Pruzanski, I think it would be necessary, I think it would be prudent at minimum to, if you go with Senate Bill 287, to put in, as you suggest, I think that's a very good and excellent idea, to put in a specific exception for homicides of some nature so that there would not need to be a specific showing in the case of a homicide that there was a specific intent to silence the witness. And that would be consistent with the way the federal courts, as I understand it, have construed the comparable federal rule.
I certainly would agree with that. And incidentally, Senator Pruzanski, we had an earlier discussion about the need for language that would make clear that the proponent can't profit from wrongdoing. And as I look at the existing language, I see that that's already in there as subpoint 2 in Rule Senate Bill 287, which is Rule 804. I see that if you were to go down to about line 16 on the first page, that's where the language presently exists that creates the symmetry as to proponent's wrongdoing and opponent's wrongdoing. But I've joined Mr. Sylvester in agreeing that that would be very useful to include the fact that murder cases will be treated as necessarily wrongful conduct even if the murder wasn't committed with the intent of silencing someone because there wasn't a trial. When you murdered the person, there hadn't been the possibility of a trial until you committed the murder. So.
Any further? Thank you. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Yes, hello. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and Chair Starr and members of the committee. My name is Cheryl O'Neill, and I'm the Executive Director at Women's Space, which is a domestic violence intervention service provider in Eugene, Oregon. And I just basically, there was a couple of things I wanted to say to you. I wanted to really thank you for addressing this issue so quickly after the Crawford passed. It has made a big impact, as I have seen it, in the prosecutions in our area. They have definitely been affected by the Crawford decision, and the filings have gone down because of it. But I think Oregon has a great history of addressing domestic violence. We have the mandatory report. You know, we were the first people to have mandatory reporting. We've done a really good job in so many ways of creating what we call a coordinated community response. The pieces are all really working well together. And I used to be the coordinator of the Lane County Domestic Violence Council, and that was one of the things we worked on quite a bit. And one of the things we were so proud of was all kinds of pieces that we had put together that really hung on Crawford, it turns out. We had put together report forms so that all the police jurisdictions throughout the county had the same report form, and that report form they were trained on by the district attorney's office. They knew how to collect enough evidence so that a case could be successfully prosecuted without the testimony of the survivor. And our prosecution rates went from in the 20th percentile to something like 88th percentile. Basically because of all of those little pieces that we put together. So we have the mandatory arrest, we have the follow through with the police department, we have what the prosecutions are able to do. And, you know, unfortunately, all of this labor and all this effort to make it much safer for people to be able to call the police and to be able to get assistance kind of falls apart now that this Crawford decision is in place. I'm not a lawyer, so I can't explain to you all the intricacies of that, but I do know how it affects people because I've worked directly with survivors. I started out as a volunteer on the crisis line, and I've worked at the domestic violence clinic at Legal Aid, working with people who are pursuing the civil remedies that Sybil Hebb was talking about, but definitely also engaged in the criminal case, in criminal cases. And you know, people who I've sat with won't even make the call to the police if something has gone wrong because they're afraid. You know, they won't even just make that call because they're too afraid of what the consequences may be, particularly, you know, violent consequences. So to expect them to then go through this very lengthy, and 6 months is not an outside estimate of how long it might take before you could get to trial, process where, you know, you're in fear, you know, for yourself. You know that this is looming. You know what the consequences might be. People are afraid of just one night, you know, something happening and the person just being mad about the one night. They're going to be waiting, waiting that time to testify. They know what the prosecution might result in. It becomes much more dangerous for the victim, and I would say that that is one of the reasons that our most recent domestic violence homicide occurred. Mrs. Benitez was, in fact, preparing to testify against her husband, who was then going to experience the consequence if the case was successful of ending up in prison for a significant period of time, and he killed her. I mean, it was as simple as that. So the danger that people fear is not unreasonable danger. You don't know what will set somebody off. And if you've lived in a situation where somebody has terrified you, you know, over a significant period of time, you know, you just don't want to be the person, you don't want to be the one that has to be responsible for what those consequences are. And that's one of the reasons we work so hard over such a long period of time, all of us together, to create this system that will make the response instead of the survivor having to take that risk. So I just want to thank you for considering this. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions? Appreciate very much your testimony. And we have one other witness, Kelly Skye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Starr, members of the committee. My name is Kelly Skye, and I'm the legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we oppose both Senate Bill 287 and 288. Primarily because we believe that there is no need to codify this doctrine which already exists in constitutional law. We come before you at a time when the United States Supreme Court has spoken and has declared a part of our evidence code unconstitutional, and so we ask that you proceed cautiously so as not to create yet another statute that will create years and years of litigation and result in overturned convictions and result in us being back here where we are today. The doctrine of forfeiture by wrongdoing, as Professor Leininger already testified, has long been recognized as a doctrine constitutionally. It was recognized by Justice Scalia in the Crawford opinion. It's most recently been discussed by the Oregon Court of Appeals in an opinion that was just issued in January of this year, State versus Page. So it's a doctrine that has been available, although perhaps not used as often is available under the constitutional doctrine. And so we believe that there's not a need to try to codify that. The lesson that was learned by the Crawford decision is that constitutional principles are very difficult, if not impossible, to codify in legislation. And so when we try to take a constitutional concept and put it in a statute, we are creating yet another layer for the courts to interpret, because ultimately it is the court's job to interpret the Constitution. And they will do that whether it's in a statute or not. That said, I go back to what I said earlier. We believe that the cautious and conservative approach to this is to let the courts continue to make decisions about the admissibility of this testimonial evidence. There are a number of things about Crawford that remain open. The definition of testimonial evidence is something that we will probably hear a lot about from the courts. And by trying to codify it, we are just creating yet another piece to be litigated. Our concerns about the litigation can somewhat be allayed, and I will say that if we were forced to choose between the two versions of the bill, we would prefer Senate Bill 287. It definitely is the more conservative approach, as Professor Leininger stated. It has years of federal law on which we can rely. The terms that are used in the federal rules present some concerns for us. The term acquiesce. By definition, acquiesce certainly can include agreeing to asking for someone to engage in the wrongdoing that causes the person to be unavailable. The questions that arise, however, are what all is included within acquiescence? Is it mere knowledge that something's going to occur? Does it then impose on the defendant a duty to report? And if they don't report, then they waive a constitutional right. And you look at the term wrongdoing, and this is an issue that Counsel Taylor raised, that I intended to raise as well. What exactly is the wrongdoing, and can it be the underlying act? I think that when Mr. Sylvester responded to that question, what he did was respond with a circumstance, sort of a worst-case scenario, the person who has, by the underlying act or conduct prior to the underlying act, has rendered someone unavailable as a witness. But what we're really talking about on a day-to-day basis is, say, for instance, the woman. I'm going to use this example because I think it's important to remember that plenty of women are charged with domestic violence crimes, and we represent them all the time. And I think it's too easy to assume that this is always just going to be used against the male batterer. So the woman hits the man. Is the mere hitting of that person going to be the wrongdoing that waives that constitutional right? Logically, it doesn't seem to make sense, because the constitutional right to confront your witnesses doesn't arise until you've committed an offense for which you're going to be tried. And it's hard to see how you can simultaneously create this constitutional right and waive it within one act. So I don't believe that that is a constitutional interpretation of the forfeiture by wrongdoing provision. And these are the kind of issues that we see going to be litigated. I think they're going to be litigated whether you act with a statute or not. And I think that this evidence is admissible whether you act with a statute or not. But if you are to act with a statute, we do prefer the language coming straight from the federal rules. Think that the specific intent is necessary. When, I think it was Mr. Sylvester, is talking about how difficult it is for the state to prove that the defendant had the specific intent. What you need to realize is, to not require the state to prove the specific intent, you're basically saying the defendant didn't have to intend that his behavior would render that witness unavailable. And that is not what's provided for in the federal rules. It's certainly never been stated in the common law doctrine of forfeiture by wrongdoing. The conservative way to approach this, and the correct way to approach this, if you do want to try to codify this doctrine that's already available at common law, is to go with the language that's already been provided and tested by federal law. And that's, I don't have anything further. I'm free to answer questions if you have any.
Questions? Any questions?
I had one.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Guy, you just sort of made your argument at the end. You repeated it, but I would agree with you that Senate Bill 287 is a cautious approach. it adopts federal law, and there's 10 years of case law behind it. So if you wanted a conservative approach, I think that's it. And I think Senator Prezonsky's idea about the exception for homicide is appropriate. Would you like to respond to that?
Yes, Chair Starr, Senator Walker, I believe that that exception already exists at common law. Just as I said, this entire doctrine exists at common law, and I believe that that is what Professor Leninger testified to as well, that that exception already applies in cases of homicide, and so that sort of takes me back to my original position, which is that it's not necessary to actually codify this, but it's already available.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else? I don't have anyone else signed up to testify. Not. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bills 287 and 288, and we will ask that council work with parties to see if we can get some amendment that might bring this back to us in a form that's more readily acceptable.
I do that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And with that, we're going to move on our list. Again, out of order, we're going to take up Senate Bill 258 next in order. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 258. Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 258 clarifies that in a violent situation where someone is charged with a violation, that they do not have a right to appointed counsel. There's no constitutional right to it, and there's some statutory ambiguity in the statute that arguably would allow someone to request appointed counsel.
Thank you. With that, invite Peter Gardland.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Could you introduce yourself and bring us your testimony, please?
Good afternoon. My name is Peter Gartland. I'm with the Office of Public Defense Services. And we're offering this this amendment to ORS 138-500 because it apparently this, we think this is just a house cleaning amendment. There is a way to read 138-500 such that someone who is convicted of a violation, and a violation is not a crime, but somebody convicted of a violation could apply for a court-appointed attorney and obtain a court-appointed attorney and a transcript at state expense. And that's a potential reading, a possible reading, and we think that's not the legislative intent at all, to allow for a court-appointed attorney and a transcript when somebody is charged with and convicted of a mere violation, because a mere violation is not a crime. So typically the rule is if it's not a crime, someone is not permitted to have a court-appointed attorney unless authorized by statute. And we don't think that this is a fair reading of the statute that would allow for a court-appointed attorney and transcript, but it's a possible reading. And we have some anecdotal stories that some judges have been appointing an attorney for in such an instance, even though there was no attorney appointed at the trial level, because there's no basis, there's no statute authorizing an attorney at the trial level. So this just seems like an anomaly that has slipped through for a few years, I haven't researched it, but I have a feeling it may have been when there were some amendments and changes a few years ago to get rid of infractions, and I think to turn infractions into violations, and for some reason this should have been cleaned up then but wasn't. So we believe this is just a house cleaning amendment.
Any questions?
I've got you. I'm sorry. I mean, I've been practicing in this area for so long. I mean, there's always been in law school that you don't have a right to an attorney unless you have a opportunity to actually see a jail. And if you don't have a potential sanction of jail, you have no right to an attorney.
Right.
And so you're telling me there are judges in this state that have actually appointed individuals after they've been convicted at the trial court level on a violation to having counsel for the purpose of appealing that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pruzanski, this might actually segue from the last set of witnesses, because I'm the only one hearsay, but that's what I've been told, that the practice has been not to appoint an attorney and not to allow for a transcript, but one or a couple of judges actually have, because they've read 138500 to allow it.
And your hearsay, if I could, Mr. Chair, could you share with us that anecdotal stories of what counties that are doing this?
You know, I don't know exactly the county, and even if I did, I might invoke the Fifth Amendment, but I really don't know. I really don't know. But I know that we did have an inquiry from somebody from Multnomah County asking about this, and they were told that, no, there is no right to an attorney or transcript based on this statute, because we believe that was not the legislative intent. But, like I said, hearsay is very unreliable, but someone did tell me that some judge should appoint an attorney for this, for violation.
Any further questioning? Certainly we shouldn't have any ambiguity. Do you have any problem moving this bill? No further questions. Thank you. We're going to close the public hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 258.
Chair.
Senator presents.
Just to make certain there's no ambiguity, I will move Senate Bill 258 with the recommendation to the floor, or with the due pass recommendation to the floor.
Senator Brzezinski has moved Senate Bill 258 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
We'll just hold their hands, Mr. Chair.
Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Yes, I will.
Thank you, Senator Pruzanski. We'll carry. And we'll move ahead with a public hearing on Senate Bill 272.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 272 comes to you from the Oregon State Bar, and what it does, it directs the Board of Governors to establish deadlines for the filing of nominating petitions. You will also see in your packet a dash two amendments, which removes a provision, proposed to remove a provision in the bill as it relates to PERS and employees of the Oregon State Bar, and then it adds another section in Section 3 concerning lawyer assistance committees. Madam Chair, members, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you very much. And Sylvia Stevens is here to explain the bill to us. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Starr, and members of the committee. I'm Sylvia Stevens. I'm the Senior Assistant General Counsel at the Oregon State Bar, and I'm here today to speak in support of Senate Bill 272 on behalf of the bar. The bill raises four issues relating to governance of the bar. They're not nearly as intellectually interesting as the things we've been listening to for the last hour and a half, but I'll do my best. The first change that the bill would do deals with elections for lawyer positions on the Board of Governors. Currently, the statute requires that nominating petitions be filed within 30 days of the election. We're proposing to delete that language and allow the Board of Governors the flexibility to set those timelines in a way that is more efficient depending on the circumstances of the election. The second change really just rewords a provision that's already in there to clarify that we will not hold elections when there are no contested positions. Again, this is for the efficiency flexibility and governance of the bar. Section 2 of Senate Bill 272 involves recall of a board member, a member of the Board of Governors. Currently, the statute has a mechanism by which members of a region from which a board member is elected can recall their representative, but there is no process for the board to initiate that kind of a recall process, and we are proposing in Senate Bill 272 to add some new language that would allow the Board of Governors to initiate a recall on a two-thirds vote of the Board of Governors, and then that would go out if the board member that it affects does not resign within 10 days. There would be an election in the region on the up or down vote on that recall. Again, this is a change that is being proposed to enhance the ability of the Board of Governors to manage its affairs and to govern itself by giving a little more flexibility to remove a member who, in the estimation of the board, is not acting in the best interest of the bar. Section 3 of the bill amends the provisions of the Bar Act that relate to the State Lawyers Assistance Committee. Some of you may be familiar with that. It is a program or a committee that was established by statute maybe 30 years ago to investigate and resolve complaints involving lawyers who have performance problems, typically their alcohol and drug abuse or mental illness issues that affect their ability to practice law. And one of the virtues of that program and that has made it successful is that there is a statutory provision of confidentiality there so that the information the bar learns in the course of working with these people and developing a remedial program is not part of the public record as are most bar records and can't be used against that lawyer in disciplinary proceedings or any other kind of proceeding. The board would like to expand the role of the State Lawyers Assistance Committee to call on its expertise in diversion cases, disciplinary diversions, probations for people who have been disciplined, and some conditional admissions to the bar. There are some people who are admitted subject to probationary conditions. And the problem they have in doing that is if there is a diversion or a probation, the person who's doing the monitoring is required to report to disciplinary counsel if the person on probation breaches the terms of their program. Because of the statutory confidentiality, there's been concern that SLAC members, the State Lawyers Assistance Committee, cannot act in that role. So what is proposed here is new language that gives the board the power to enhance the scope of what the State Lawyers Assistance Committee does in diversion and probation monitoring and supervision, and then exempts it from that confidentiality provision. In effect, it creates a second track for the State Lawyers Assistance Committee to allow it to do this other work that it has the expertise for, but without binding its hands on the confidentiality. And then finally, the last change in the Bar Act that is in Senate Bill 272 would amend the provisions of the statute that deal with the Client Security Fund. More than 30 years ago, we created the Client Security Fund as a way to reimburse clients whose lawyers steal their money. And the statute as it currently is written limits claims to Oregon lawyers who maintain an office in Oregon. Otherwise, their clients cannot recover from them. As you're probably well aware, lawyers travel across state lines much more now than they used to, and there's a lot more multi-state practice going on. Under the current language of the statute, if a lawyer, and we had this case actually, an Idaho lawyer who was also licensed in Oregon was representing clients in Oregon courts, Oregon clients, but he didn't maintain an office in Oregon. And when those clients then felt that he had stolen their money, they were not able to make a claim to our client security fund because we don't have the authority to pay them because he doesn't maintain an office in Oregon. So we are proposing to delete that language, substitute for it only a requirement that the lawyer have been engaged in the practice of law in Oregon in connection with the loss, which we think is going to be more fair with the increasing numbers of lawyers from other states who are licensed here but don't maintain offices here as they're not required to do.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Crozanz.
Could I just interject on that one point? Is there still going to be a requirement that that person is lawfully practicing law within the state? In other words, they are licensed here as compared to someone that may not have the authority to practice?
Senator Starr and Senator Przanski, the statute currently requires that they be a member of the Oregon State Bar,
okay.
So it won't allow lawyers who aren't licensed here but who might be legitimately practicing here temporarily. It will not cover them. And we've been careful to make that distinction. So I would urge that the committee move this bill to the full Senate with a due pass recommendation, and I thank you for the opportunity to explain it to you today, and I'll be happy to answer any questions anybody has.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to follow up on that. So if someone is appearing pro hac vice, that will be covered under this change?
I don't believe so. Chair Starr and Senator Walker, I believe, and I don't have the full statute statutory provision in front of me, but I think they have to be members of the Oregon State Bar. A pro hoc vice lawyer is by definition a member of another state's bar and is allowed to practice here only in connection with a particular case that's pending here. It's not been our intention to expand the scope of the program to people who are not licensed in Oregon. We just want to make sure that lawyers who are dual licensed. So in the case of the Idaho lawyer I was talking about, he was licensed in both states and permitted to practice fully in both states, but only had one office.
So the parties would have an action against the lawyer in their home state rather than...
Well, here. Client security funds have different rules everywhere, and I'm not sure they're going to be able to recover in Idaho because they are concerned that he was practicing in Oregon at the time, and their rules don't allow it. Mm-hmm. So those people may not be able to recover at all unless we can squeeze the statute.
I think I want to follow up what Senator Walker said, because, I mean, it just seems if we're trying to do the right thing for a client, it seems like if we're giving someone a special appearance to come in and practice on a particular case, I know they're going to be associated with a firm usually here in the state. It seems like there should be some recourse for those citizens to be able to address or ask for redress of an issue that might present itself.
Chair Starr and Senator Prezansky, I fully understand and sympathize with the situation you're describing. There are similar funds in every jurisdiction, and those of us who work with them talk about this every year at an annual meeting. I think most states agree that they want to limit their payments out to their own admitted lawyers because in the case of a pro hoc vice lawyer, say from Washington, the clients who are harmed by that lawyer can generally go to Washington and be compensated there, because that person is a Washington lawyer and they have a fund that covers them. Again, multi-state practice is causing all of us to kind of rethink the language of our rules that has historically contemplated that lawyers only practice within the borders of the states in which they're originally licensed, and that isn't the case anymore. But we want to make sure that Oregon lawyers are contributing to compensation for Oregon lawyers as opposed to lawyers in other states who just happen to be here on an isolated case.
Mr. Chair, if I can follow up with that.
Yes, Senator Prezansky.
If your previous annual conversations or in this next annual conversation, if you would discuss whether or not there should be some type of reciprocity element there, that if we're allowing an attorney from a given state to come in for these special cases, that our citizens would in fact at least be informed as to the risk they may have, if not being able to go back to that state's bar or whatever association to seek any redress they think is appropriate.
I'll be happy to. Thank you.
Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I practice in federal court as a court reporter, so that's where I see that. And we do have a lot of pro hoc vice attorneys. I don't know if you have it so much in state court. But we certainly do in federal court. So I agree with Senator Prezansky. I'd like some more discussion about that. But we have usually big clients with lots of money, and I don't think they'd be too awfully worried. But, you know, there are occasional folks who are just regular people represented by another lawyer from another state, particularly if you're on the line down near Klamath Falls and near the borders.
Yes.
We get a lot of
Chair
attorneys.
Starr and Senator Walker. Again, I don't disagree with you. There are some states that are beginning to look at requiring that some portion of the pro hoc vice fee be paid into the client security fund of their state to cover just those kinds of incidences.
That would be good.
In Oregon, we don't do that. The pro hoc vice fee goes to low-income legal services. So when a lawyer comes here, the client security fund doesn't get any of the fees that lawyer pays. And there's been sort of a sense, I think, and frankly, we've not discussed this a lot in Oregon, but been sort of a sense that they're not paying into the fund. We shouldn't reimburse their clients, whether that necessarily makes sense. I think we're going to have this dialogue around the country for quite a while.
Further?
I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Taylor.
Chair Member of the Committee, Council. Stephen, do you have an additional amendment, do you not?
Oh, I do, and I'm sorry, I forgot to mention that, Chair Starr and members of the committee. When the language of Senate Bill 272-2 that you have shows a provision of the statute being repealed, which in retrospect we've decided we should leave in, And so I've proposed some substitute language for that provision of the statute, which is ORS 95681C, which puts back what we took out except deletes the references to the local lawyers' assistance committees, because we're taking out the reference to local lawyers' assistance committee throughout the that whole statutory scheme, since we don't use them. They're sort of redundant. So we would ask that that language be substituted back in for what was previously going to be taken out.
Thank you. We will wait for council to complete that work and not bring the bill back until we have amended bill. And with that, thank you very much. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 272. And we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 257. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Let me just give a brief background as to what post-conviction relief is. Post-conviction relief usually comes up when a person is sitting in prison. They've had a trial in the circuit court. They've run through their appeals in the appellate court system. And they're in prison, and they'll often argue, for example, inadequate assistance of counsel in violation of the Oregon and United States Constitution. The right of post-conviction relief is a statutory right. Post-conviction relief is considered more in the nature of civil than criminal. There is no constitutional right to counsel. We have had this issue before us in the past. It's an issue that oftentimes comes up in the Ways and Means context. I think what you will see here is an issue of orderly administration of justice. As you'll notice, that you'll see no witnesses signed up from here. And I think what this will be is the issue of how much it would reduce the expense of defense versus how much it would increase the cost of the Department of Justice and the court system.
Thank you. See, we have three witnesses signed up. We've got three chairs up here. Peter Ozani, Mary Williams, and Kelly Skye. Would you all come up? Choose your order of presentation or the way you signed up, that'd be fine, and introduce yourself. We'd hear your testimony.
Chairman Starr, senators, members of the committee, my name is Peter Ozan. I'm executive director of the Public Defense Services Commission. I sat down first, so I'll go first with the permission of the chair.
Yes.
Your counsel has ably described the substance of this bill and post-conviction relief. I will give my formal testimony in just a moment. I wanted to summarize it by saying, as a member and the commission as part of the public defense community, the committee might expect us to be here to talk about rights without remedies and defending rights that are difficult to enforce without the assistance of counsel. That is true, and others will speak to that. And I, secondly, I know there's a concern about cost savings, and I will speak to that. But I want to give you a slightly different perspective from the Public Defense Services Commission, created by the legislature. And our mission, as directed by the legislature, is to provide quality, cost-efficient services, public defense services. And we see the post-conviction relief process as a fundamental mechanism to ensure quality and cost efficiency, because it's essentially a police or function or check on the competency of lawyers. I'll explain that in a minute. As already mentioned, post-conviction relief cases represent a relatively small proportion of the total number of cases requiring court-appointed counsel. Last I looked, in 2004, there were about under 600 post-conviction relief cases and approximately over 150,000 public defense cases. But these cases can be relatively complex and expensive. So as to the cost, which I know you're concerned about, the elimination of counsel in post-conviction relief cases would reduce the cost, we estimate, in 2005-07, the next the biennium, by $1.9 million, keeping in mind, depending on whose budget is passed, somewhere, but just to give you a perspective, that's somewhere between about $153 and $166 million total biennium budget. So it would be a little over 1% of our costs. And then we estimate the following biennium with caseload growth that the cost savings would be about $2.6 million. You'll hear, as I indicated, representatives from other agencies today to talk about the offsetting costs, so I won't take time, and it's really not my expertise, but there certainly are, from our perspective, some offsetting costs to other agencies to have folks bringing their post-conviction relief cases without the aid of counsel, because counsel, as all of you know, helped to focus the issues, and all of us lawyers know that cases are far more difficult to proceed with and to complete efficiency when the other side doesn't have a lawyer. But to the point I wanted to make from our perspective about quality and cost efficiency, at least 90% of the post-conviction relief proceedings, I've referred to it here as PCR, that's how it's referred to among lawyers, involve complaints by convicted defendants that the legal representations provided by either trial or appellate counsel was inadequate. That's what most of these cases are about. Was my lawyer delivering competent services? Therefore, the commission opposes the passage of Senate Bill 257 from its perspective on the grounds that these proceedings, when conducted with the assistance of court-appointed counsel, provide a potential assurance and a strong assurance of competency and quality. Again, it's a policing function. It creates the notion of a deterrent to incompetent and sloppy lawyering. Now, fortunately, I can say to you, and so could the bar or any other lawyer, that successful post-conviction relief cases are few, that the complaints are generally not borne out. But the commission believes that offering defendants the opportunity to challenge the adequacy of their legal representation without a lawyer would be an illusory right and an illusory remedy, and really would eliminate this essential check that the commission believes is critical to check on the cost efficiency and quality of public defense services in Oregon. Now let me just take this opportunity briefly to make another point. I've referred to the PCR, or post-conviction relief proceedings, as a potential assurance of competency and quality of public defense services. I use the adjective potential because the manner in which the legislature historically has authorized, prior to our arrival, the commission authorized the Judicial Department and now the Public Defense Services Commission to administer this process really prevents the process from realizing its potential. Now, the commission has studied post-conviction relief, has talked to lawyers across the state, both prosecutors and defense attorneys, and reached this conclusion that the delivery of the public defense service, the delivery of these services through the current public defense system, the contracting system, compromises its effectiveness and really prevents focusing on cases with merit and ignoring cases without merit. How this system will work efficiently from a defense perspective is that the cases that matter, where there really is incompetence, those cases should be investigated thoroughly, should be focused on, and the lawyers and Public Defense Services Commission money should be spent on those cases that matter. And I'm here to report to you, under the current contracting process, where we contract with private attorneys to do the work, individual attorneys, that is not being done effectively, in my opinion. And two state bar studies, independent bar studies, have concluded as much. And why would that be, thinking about it? Since these are bringing complaints against lawyers, it's not the way for a member of a private bar in a small town where most of these cases are commenced to generate business by attacking the competency of other lawyers. So I know this is not the committee to talk about funding, but I wanted to bring this to your attention. The commission and I have concluded that the public defense services and post-conviction release proceedings should be administered with direct oversight by the commission in a separate division of my office, the Office of Public Defense Services, We already have the State Public Defender's Office. We call it the Legal Services Division that handles appeals in all criminal cases. What the Commission believes we need is a separate division with a division manager or supervisor and three full-time post-conviction relief attorney specialists. And since we currently are fully engaged in handling appeals, we have before the Ways and Means Committee this session a proposal that's in the Chief Justice's recommended budget for our commission that would establish a four-lawyer division of the Office of Public Defense Services, my office. And with the direct management of the commission and oversight by my office, and with attorney specialists who have the capacity to focus on the PCR cases that matter, this process, which should have lawyers, will realize its potential as a true check on the competency and quality of lawyering in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Questions? Thank you. Please.
For the record, I'm Mary Williams, Solicitor General in the Oregon Department of Justice. We oppose this bill to the extent that it's an effort to have cost savings in the system. Last month, as part of the broad overview of the criminal justice system, you heard a lot about how the different parts of the system are interconnected. And this bill is a very good example of the difficulty when you focus on one part of that system and don't look at the larger context of it. A bill like this will give you a savings when you look simply at indigent defense. But what it actually will do is shift the cost from indigent defense to other parts of the system, primarily, we believe, to the Department of Justice and to the courts. We have experience dealing with cases where an attorney is not involved, pro se cases, and experience dealing with cases where an attorney is involved. And we've tried to come up with numbers that will allow us to quantify the different costs. We haven't been able to actually pin down numbers. And so we have to rely on our best estimate of how much more difficult it is, how much more time-consuming it is to deal with a case where a lawyer is not involved on the other side. The most conservative estimate we can give you from talking to experienced practitioners is that it will increase the cost by about one-third. Some of our estimates were that it's more likely that it will actually double our cost. And so we prepared a fiscal impact statement on this using that conservative figure that would show an additional cost for the Department of Justice of over $1.8 million. Part of that additional cost is simply that the system does work more smoothly when lawyers are involved, and I think especially when good lawyers are involved. The lawyers understand which issues can be pressed, which issues should not be pressed. They understand simply the procedural process for dealing with these cases. Pro se litigants, you often will see motions that are not appropriate for the process and that gum up the works, as a legal term, and make it much more complicated to have these cases move through the system. We also have a concern that the next stage of review for criminal defendants, once they get past post-conviction, is to go to the federal courts into federal habeas, and that eliminating counsel in the post-conviction process is actually going to increase our cost when we get to the federal courts. At this point, the way the system is organized, a criminal defendant has to take his claims first to the state courts before he can bring them to the federal courts. And then once they're in the federal courts have to defer to factual findings that were made in the state courts. If we don't have counsel in post-conviction cases, there's a possibility that the federal courts will no longer defer to the findings of the state courts and will open the door to the kinds of issues that they are willing to consider in federal habeas. And we know that it is always more costly for the state to defend these cases in federal court than it is in state court. And those are additional costs that we haven't even begun to try to estimate what the implication would be for federal habeas. And we likely wouldn't see it in the 0507 biennium, but we would see it down the road as the cases move through the system. And finally, I would agree with Mr. Ozan's comments about there may be other ways of looking for savings in the system. And we have about a third of our defense of criminal convictions budget goes to post-conviction cases, and I think we've achieved efficiency through the kind of centralization and specialization that Mr. Ozan is suggesting. So there may be ways to find some savings in the system, but this particular bill is not likely to be one of them.
Thank you. Questions?
Counsel. Chair, members of the committee. So, Williams, you mentioned that this would cost you conservatively $1.6 million. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Counsel Taylor, it's $1.8 million.
$1.8 million, and the savings would be $1.9 from Peter Ozan. And my assumption is that this would also cause additional costs for the courts. And it's safe to say it would be more than $100,000.
Mr. Chair and Counsel Taylor, I believe that's accurate.
Any further? Thank you very much. Yes.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, Kelly Skye again on behalf of the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we, too, oppose Senate Bill 257. And what I would like to do is sort of go back and talk about the reasons why we have post-conviction relief, to just sort of a refresher. And that really is... because innocent people do get accused of crimes, innocent people do get convicted of crimes, and defendants do, in the state of Oregon, on occasion, get ineffective assistance of counsel. Those are claims that cannot be raised on direct appeal. So when a person is convicted of an offense, the claims that can be raised on direct appeal are legal claims having to do with the offense itself, not with the amount of work that their attorney put in to their case. Those claims are only available through post-conviction relief. Now we have a statutory procedure for post-conviction relief here in the state, and that's what we're talking about. And then there's also a federal statutory basis. What Solicitor Williams was talking about in terms of her concerns that at the federal level, the federal courts would not give deference to the state court's findings. The other side of that could be that the federal level will continue to give deference to the state court findings, and unrepresented defendants who haven't been able to present their claims on their own will automatically then waive all of those claims that they could make at the federal level. This basically renders post-conviction relief meaningless, because your average criminal defendant who is making claims of ineffective assistance of counsel is not able to recognize a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. They're not able to recognize where their attorney may not have investigated a case properly, may not have raised particularly constitutional claims. And so if they don't recognize those and don't raise them at the state level, they will be then waived at the federal level, and there will be essentially no review of the attorney's work. And if that work was incompetent or ineffective, that person will have no remedy whatsoever. Post-conviction relief cases, it's important also to remember what the indigent defense attorney or the court-appointed attorney does in those cases, and a good portion of what we currently do in those cases would then later be done instead by the courts and by the Department of Justice, because we start by meeting with the client, listening to their concerns and their complaints, and trying to call out what are meritorious claims and what are not, and advising that client as to which claims are meritorious and which are not. Then that is a job that would then need to be done by the Department of Justice as they receive the voluminous pleadings that usually accompany a pro se litigant's case. And the courts would also be required to go through the voluminous pleadings, and the courts and the Department of Justice would need to call out the meritorious claims, address those claims, and address the claims that are not meritorious that were raised because the unrepresented litigant didn't understand that they were brought improperly. The court-appointed attorneys then also investigate, especially if it's a claim of failure to investigate. They may go out and investigate and see whether there's something out there that the trial attorney could have found but missed. They file pleadings. They communicate with the defendant. They communicate with the court. They explain the process to the defendant. And the laws are, the way that we have this procedure written, the laws are written for attorneys. It's an attorney-friendly, not a pro se litigant-friendly system. So if you were to take the attorneys out of the process, you're going to have a process that's not understood by pro se litigants, and it's going to be the courts and the Department of Justice that have to direct these claims through the system. And generally, Department of Justice attorneys and courts don't want to be put in a situation where they may be asked questions by an unrepresented litigant and be put in a position where they're asked for legal advice, where they need to should be careful about how they communicate with that person so that it's not construed that they're giving legal advice. Those are the kind of things that that a court-appointed attorney does that will fall upon other parts of the system if you were not to have court-appointed counsel in these cases. So we oppose this bill, and we'd urge that you continue to provide funding for court-appointed attorneys in post-conviction relief cases for all the reasons stated by the other members of the panel as well.
Thank you very much. Questions? Very satisfying testimony for opposition to this little bill. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 257. Senator Burdick, any direction for your committee?
Senator Burdick, can you speak up?
Senator Starr, you did a fabulous job as usual. Thank you very much.
Well, glad to assist, and we look forward to seeing you back with us. Thank you. With that, we're going to adjourn the Senate Committee on Judiciary for another day, and we will.